Case numbers 22-1079 and 22-1111, Painting Contractor LLC versus NLRB. Arguments 15 minutes for the petitioner, 12 for respondent, 3 for the intervener. Mr. Greenberg, you may proceed for the petitioner.
My name is Gary Greenberg, and I represent the petitioner, a cross-respondent in this case, the Painting Contractor LLC. With me today at council table is my colleague Alessandro Ota Blonde, who is also on the brief. A painting contractor also describes what my client does for its customers. I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, with your permission.
You have it. Very well.
Thank you. This case concerns a government agency, the National Labor Relations Board, erroneously imposing liability on the company on behalf of the Painters Union District Council 6. The board erred by ignoring and therefore contradicting the plain language of the contract that was in effect between the Employers Association that the company previously belonged to and the union. The Employers Association, which the company had timely withdrawn from. Now, in Gratiot Hospital, I may be mispronouncing that, versus NLRB in 1995, this court held, and I'm quoting, "The board's interpretation of contract terms is subject to de novo review," citing a Supreme Court decision, Litton Financial Printing. The key to this case is a de novo textual analysis of Article 19 of the contract that was in effect at the time. The contract that was in effect from 2016 to 2019 between the Employers Association and the union. I'd like to go through the applicable language with the court and comment on each applicable part of the text. And what we're talking about here is the second sentence of Article 19 of the contract. And it begins by saying that any contractor that decides to withdraw from the Greater Cincinnati Painting Contractors Association and negotiate separately, and I'll stop there to comment. This the introductory phrase is a straightforward statement to the contractors, the members of the employer association and the union of what needs to be done for a member to be able to withdraw and bargain separately. Article 19 goes on to say, and may do so only at the expiration of this agreement. Now this clause means—
I asked you about expiration of this agreement. I'm having some confusion about when this agreement expired. The original agreement, because as my reading of it is, with the second extension, the agreement actually ended when the second extension ended, because the union went on strike at that point. Is that fair to say that the agreement had ended at that point when the union went on strike?
It did end at that point, although—
Okay, so if the agreement ended at that point, my understanding is each of the employers could have separately negotiated a new agreement at that point when the agreement ended. Is that not correct?
Well, the case law on that is controversial, and that's not the argument we're making here.
No, but I'd like to explore that. Is that the case that each employer could have separately negotiated an agreement at that point when the agreement ended at the end of the second extension?
Again, that's a controversial point. That's not the argument that we're making here.
And will you answer my question?
Our position would be that yes, they could.
Okay. Then if that's the case, then your client then entered into negotiations with the union for the that resulted in a vote on the third extension, and you voted against it, your client did, but they nonetheless were part of those negotiations. Is that correct?
Our client attended a meeting at which the association and the union reached a third agreement. But what's key here is that before that, our client sent a notice to the association and the union. They didn't say in their notice, we're withdrawing today. They said...
But they didn't send a notice after the agreement had ended. Isn't that correct? You said the agreement ended with the second extension. When it ended, the agreement ended at that point, but there was no notice at that point.
But, Your Honor, the agreement was reinstated on May 28.
Okay.
Therefore,
it was reinstated. Was there a notice then sent?
Yes.
When?
That same day.
It was a notice to end the... Okay.
I guess
I'm having confusion is when you entered into the third extension, I'm viewing that as actually a new agreement that you're entering into, not the original agreement.
No, it wasn't. Look, Your Honor, everything in this case turns on the application of Article 19 to four key events. The notice to withdraw that the company sent on May 17, the tentative agreement that was reached on May 28, the extension agreement that was signed a few minutes later that same day, and then the ratification that occurred on June 5. Actually, there's a fifth event that's important as well, because on May 28, when the company learned that an extension agreement had been signed, the company sent an email to the union that same day and said, in light of the fact you've signed another extension, and in light of the fact that we sent you that withdrawal notice that said, if you sign another extension, we're going to withdraw, we're withdrawn, we're out. And Your Honor, back in 1969, this court ruled in a case called Lear-Siegler versus United Auto Workers, the court said as follows, the method of ratification, unless otherwise stipulated by the parties, is an internal concern of the union until it ratifies the agreement and executes the formal instrument, the contract does not become operative. So when the association and the union reached a tentative agreement on May 28, subject to ratification at a later date, that contract was not operative, not on May 28. That same day, the company or the union and the association signed an extension agreement which reinstated the previous labor agreement, including Article 19. That same day, later that day, the company sent an email to the union saying, we're out, and we're going to bargain separately. So what we have here is this. The new agreement was not operative. That's black letter case law. There was a tentative agreement, but there wasn't a binding contract. It wasn't binding on the association, it wasn't binding on the company, and it wasn't binding on the union, not on May 28. But what was binding was the company's notice of withdrawal, sent on May 17. This was the company essentially proposing to the association and the union, if you sign a third extension, if you do that, we're out by operation of Article 19. It's exactly what happened. When the association and the union chose to sign another extension later that day on May 28, they essentially accepted the company's proposal that if you do that, we're out and we're going to bargain separately. They could have chosen to do something different. In labor negotiations, a company or an employer's association and a union, when a contract expires, they can extend the contract or not. The employees could have returned to work without an extension agreement or stayed on strike. The union and the association made the choice to accept the company's notice. Again, you can look at it as a proposal. The company is saying, we're looking at Article 19. Article 19 says very clearly that if we send you a notice of withdrawal more than 3 days in advance of another extension agreement, we can withdraw and we're privileged to negotiate separately. So the company sends that notice, and on May 28, at a time when the new contract was not operative, again, that's black letter case law, the association and the union decided to accept the company's notice by signing an extension. That made the company's notice operative, which meant from that moment forward, the company was privileged to negotiate separately. And if there had been any question about that whatsoever, there shouldn't have been, but if there was, the company confirmed its withdrawal that same day with a letter, with an email to the union that said, you signed an extension, we sent you that notice, we are now out of the association, we wish to negotiate separately, let's have a meeting. Let's have a meeting. And of course, as we know, and the reason we're here is that the union rejected the company's position, insisted that the company was still part of the association, was bound by the new agreement that was ratified on June 6th, and the company persistently offered to meet with the union to negotiate a new contract. The union persistently refused. That went on for 5 months, and so finally the company implemented the proposal that it made to the union for a separate agreement. So it doesn't really matter.
Thank you, Mr. Greenberg.
Okay. Is my time up? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Greg Lauro for the National Labor Relations Board, asking this court to enforce the board's order because it is supported by both substantial evidence on the record and settled precedent. I think going to the—
You're arguing 12 minutes? You have 12 minutes for your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then the union has three?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to start with the company's own words here on their notice of withdrawal from the association. As the board found, the company decided to word its notice so that they would effectively be out upon an event, the third extension, that occurred after the parties had already reached a new agreement. If there were any doubt about that, the company repeated it later, saying on May 25th, just to be clear, we were not out before that.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you the same questions I asked to the contractors as far as what the law is. So when the union went on strike, is it the board's position that the agreement had ended at that point?
The agreement as extended expired May 23rd, and the union went on strike after that. But the union—
Is it fair to say for that five-day period there was no agreement between the employers and the employees?
Between, say, May 24th and May 27th.
Yeah, whatever that period was.
Right. At that point, when
you were in that period, you would say there was no agreement.
There was no operative agreement at that time. Now, the board.
So what I'm having difficulty with is this notice of withdrawal was actually sent. It was sent while the agreement was in force. The agreement went out of force. There was no agreement for about a four-day period. And then there was an extension for the original agreement entered into. And I'm trying to understand, is it really an extension or is it actually a new agreement that was entered into after the four-day period? Because if it's a new agreement, it seems like the painting contractor would then have a duty to do another notice of withdrawal in order to get out of that new agreement. So that's what's confusing me, because there's a period there where there's no agreement. So it's kind of hard to say that this agreement continued, because it seems to me it ended when the strike took place. And then there was a new agreement entered into when you had the extension, albeit it was instituting the original agreement, but still it was not, you had a discrete period of time where there was no agreement. Now, am I missing something in the facts as to what happened?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think...
So I guess what I'm saying is it possible to affirm the board simply on the basis that there was no notice of withdrawal that was made by the painting contractor after the new agreement went into effect with the third extension?
Your Honor, I think what we have are two roads there that lead to the same place.
Right.
That we don't have timely withdrawal. What the board found, and this is what the party stipulated to.
But I mean, if we're looking at this de novo, interpreting an agreement, couldn't we affirm the board on that theory that I just enunciated?
Well,
based on the way, just looking at the contractual language of the agreements.
A couple things, if I may, Your Honor. I just want to be clear about the two roads, and I don't know if I agree that what this case turns on is de novo review of a contract.
I didn't think you might agree to that, but...
Right. That won't knock you over with a feather, I understand. But the two roads are, there's what you mentioned, that one could try and argue that if the agreement had expired, none was in effect. When it's reinstated, you might think a new notice was required. I'm not going to sit here
and
say...
But let me ask you this. He said it was controversial about whether the employers could have then gone their separate ways in that four-day period. What would the board's position be on that?
Well, if I'm remembering correctly what that was, the duty to withdraw, once an employer joins a multi-employer bargaining association, they are in until they timely and unequivocally withdraw, according to the rules set
up by the board. But if the agreement did end with a strike, then all bets are off at that point. Each employer could do their own negotiation at that point.
I don't think that's true, if I understand Your Honor's question.
So that's what I want to understand, what the law is on that.
As to the law, there's a distinction between a multi-employer bargaining agreement ending and the fact you're represented by the association ending. When a contract ends, you're still a member of the association until you've withdrawn. Okay. In fact, when the contract ends, if you're still a member when the next agreement's reached, you're bound by it. And to answer Your Honor's questions this morning, what I'm trying to get at is, let's start with what the board found, because I think this part's clear. And
okay.
As you'll
but
see,
you're not discounting this alternative theory. You're not saying there's something in the law that would prevent us from going that direction.
Well,
I'm willing to hear the way the board did it, but I'm trying to think through this alternative rationale, and I'm wondering, is there anything I'm missing to go with that rationale?
Your Honor, I don't know there's anything you're missing. I'm just being candid that I have to start with what the board actually found, and I'm perfectly happy to discuss both those roads that lead to the
same place. I just want to get on the record whether you have any objection to that approach. But we can go back and look at the way...
Oh, sure. I just want to start with what I frankly think is the easy case here. What did the employer say? They said, we are out if there's another extension, that would be the third one, and if that happens, we are out contemporaneous with that event. Now, what happened here is that event occurred after a new agreement had been reached, and settled law says that if you're a member of the association when an agreement is reached, you're bound by it.
Now, the problem with your approach is that we've got this question of whether ratification is necessary for the new agreement to be reached. Now, you're going to say, I think your argument is ratification is not necessary, right?
Not necessary to reaching a binding agreement.
Yeah.
That's correct. And I just wanted
binding
to be clear.
Binding on whom?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Not binding on the union. In your briefing, you say it's not binding on the union until they ratify, but it's binding on the other side whether or not there's been ratification, which is a little troubling when you think about contract law.
Candidly, Your Honor, that's not how I read the law or our brief. And I think in our brief we explain both parties are subject to the same rules there. And I believe we cite the Truck Drivers Local 100 case, where those were the facts. The parties had reached an agreement, but it hadn't been ratified. The union tried to get out, and the court enforcing the board said, no, you have to meet the standard you didn't meet, which is proving an express mutual agreement. So the same rules do apply. I think what gets what needs to be explained is that you can have a binding agreement, but its effective date could still be set by ratification. Now, that's different than it being a condition precedent to formation.
What do we make of the fact it was called a tentative agreement?
Well, Your Honor, that may just refer, in the board's view, and the record supports this, to a self-imposed ratification requirement. In fact, when you look at the case law, we believe we cite the Williams House case, Seneca Environmental from this court, what are those cases saying? Just the fact the union has a practice of ratifying agreements, that the other parties know that they might have talked about, oh, we have to ratify, something's tentative.
Just the principle of basic agency law, if you know that an agent has these conditions imposed by the principal, that is imported into the agreement itself. I mean, it seems like, you know, if we went in, you know, if I went into, I don't know, if we're going in any kind of contract and you're doing it on behalf of someone else, it's, you don't really have the agreement until you have a clear authority that you can enter into the agreement. And it seems like the ratification is where that comes.
Well, actually, not quite, Your Honor. And stepping back, I understand there's different contexts for contracts, but this being the National Labor Relations Act and multi-employer bargaining, and the Supreme Court and other courts noting the board does have authority to make special rules for contract formation in that context. What's happening here is there is the assumption that when, in this case, a union and association get together, they each have apparent authority to bind their principal. And that did happen here. I mean, that's kind of the board's point. As they sit and bargain.
So what's the point then of ratification? What if the union said, no, we don't like this?
Well, under settled law, that's the distinction between a binding contract, the date you form a contract, and the date it becomes effective. And I don't think that's foreign to common understandings of contract law. You can reach a binding agreement whose effectiveness might be triggered at a later date. And you know, and as explained in the brief,
what if its effectiveness was never triggered because the parties said, no, we don't like this and we're not going to do it? What happens in that interim period?
Well, in this case, fortunately in this case, it was ratified. On May 28th, they reached a binding new agreement. And I want to be clear, that binding new agreement was reached before the withdrawal was going to go into effect, according to the employer's own wording and stipulation. So we have a binding agreement on May 28th. The parties can't just walk away and say, change my mind. That's, for example, this court's decision in Truck Drivers 100. Then the agreement is ratified on June 5th. That's undisputed, and the contract is effective at that date, meaning there's a duty to implement the terms, because there's a side agreement that says, if it's ratified by June 5th, certain economic terms go into effect retroactively. So for my opponent, that's really two ways to lose. They had a binding agreement on May 28th, meaning you can't just walk away, and then it became operative or effective, or whatever term you want to use, upon admitted ratification on June 5th. Now, your Honor's question, if the facts were different, that may be a case the board will have to address at another time. What if it had never been ratified and the parties were just waiting? But there's nothing saying the employer or the union, if they were similarly situated, could do what the employer did here, which is after May 28th, just walk away. In this case, based on an untimely withdrawal, but also based on ratification, which wasn't proven to be an express condition precedent to contract formation. They formed a binding agreement. There's no dispute about meeting of the minds, and the employer tried to just walk away.
If the extension, the third extension, had been agreed to immediately before they agreed to this tentative and you call binding agreement, would your argument be the same?
Well, with different facts, we can have different results.
No, but I'm just trying to figure out where you're really coming from here.
Where I'm really coming from here, Your Honor, is that the employer, chose the wording of its notice. And what they chose to do was say, we'll be out upon an event which happened to occur after the parties reached a new agreement. And under settled law, a member of an association is bound by an agreement reached by the association while you're still a member. That's the board's position. That's what happened here. And it's also the board's position that the employer didn't meet its burden of proving that the parties expressly agreed to ratification as a condition precedent to just forming a contract, not it being effective to even having a contract. And under settled law, they weren't privileged to do what they did, which is just try and walk away on May 28th and demand separate bargaining for a different agreement. That's the board's position.
Thank you, Mr. Lauro.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Manish Sharma. I'm here for Intervenor Union. Just quickly to address Judge Bush, your point about an alternate theory for affirming the board, I think that that would be correct, especially here because what's happening is that the board has its default rules about when an employer can withdraw from a multi-employer bargaining unit once negotiations have begun. And the company is relying on Article 19 to say, well, we were removed from those default rules because of this. So at the time the contract was expired, only the board's default rules applied. And then the contract comes back through the third extension. At that point, I do think it makes sense to say that another notice was needed to trigger, because otherwise you were just bound by the default rules prior to that. So that point, and then as far as the other points I wanted to make were that the board's approach here to ratification that we explain in our brief is really a balancing of its statutory policies. And there's several principles at play. And one is that the board assumes as part of its good faith bargaining principles that the agents who come to the bargaining table have the authority to bind their parties. Because the what they don't want is for the parties to come to an agreement and then walk away and one of them say, you know what, we never came to an agreement because the agent we said didn't have the authority to do that. So it was for purposes of good faith bargaining, the board is developed over decades, they say that your agent has to be able to have that authority. Second, the act gives the union the authority to bind its membership without its membership's approval. But third, countervailing to that, is that this court and the board have held that the membership can decide what sort of authority it gives to its bargainers. And so in balancing that, what the board has said is that you can have, when it comes to ratification, there's sort of these two different ways it can go. You can either have a condition precedent where the parties at the table agree expressly that ratification is required in order to have a acceptance of that agreement. Essentially what it's saying is that the union is giving up its authority to enter into a binding agreement and that the membership, through ratification, they are the ones who accept the final proposal, but they need to be have an express agreement for that because the union is giving something up, giving up a statutory right. The other one is a self-imposed ratification requirement where the union itself says, we need to do this because of our constitution, we have a local policy, whatever it is. In that situation, you don't need ratification for acceptance, what you need is ratification to execute the agreement, that is to perform under the agreement, and that's what we have here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sharma.
Yep.
Yes, I'd like to address the alternative theory. In the record, you'll see that the parties stipulated that, and this is at JA 557, the union and association also agreed to extend the old CBA through June 5, 2019 to allow the membership to end the strike and return to work until TA3 could be voted on June 5, 2019, the third extension agreement was executed by the union and association on May 28. Also, chief union spokesperson Jim Sherwood admitted in his testimony that he received the company's notice of withdrawal on May 17. He read it and he understood that it tracked Article 19 exactly. Therefore, the court, because it's in the record, because it was stipulated by the parties, must treat the third extension agreement as an extension agreement within the meaning of Article 19. Which brings us to the board decision and the arguments that the union and the and general counsel is making that they must prevail because of the tentative agreement. In reality,
we go with your argument as far as that this ratification was required, okay? I guess I'm having trouble. We have a, do we, what's our, what is our remedy here? Do we remand for the board to consider more evidence as to whether or not ratification was required?
No, because the facts are undisputed. And as I read in Lear-Siegler, this court has said, and this is black letter law, a union contract is not operative if a tentative agreement is not final until it's ratified. So what happened here is really essentially, think about it in terms of contract law. A tentative agreement subject to ratification
is... Is there a difference between final and binding?
No, final and binding is the same thing.
So your position is that final and binding are the same?
Yes.
But the NLRB's position is that they are not. You would agree with that?
Which is mysterious. You know, in reality, and again, this is black letter law, and really the union's brief admits this when it says that until ratified, a tentative agreement is not binding on either party. So really, essentially, if you think about this in terms of contract law, a tentative agreement subject to ratification is merely an offer by the employer that the union negotiators have said, okay, we'll call this a tentative agreement, which means we'll take it back to the members for ratification. It's not a binding, final and binding agreement until it's accepted by the membership. That didn't happen until June 5. And before then, Article 19 made the company's notice of withdrawal operative when the extension agreement was signed. And therefore, the company was privileged to negotiate separately. Thank you very much.
Mr. Berg, we will take the case under submission.
Thank you.